Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, here we go. Welcome back. We got so much to talk about. You know, it's crazy what's currently going on, but it's fascinating. I love it. Well, I wouldn't say I love it. I think it's there's just a lot of ridiculous stuff going on right now. I think it's kind of the height of ridiculousness. Quite honestly, what I'm seeing right now reminds me a lot of late 2007. And look, we're not trying to induce fear here. I don't believe in it. Fear and greed need to stay on the sidelines. We need to be clear-eyed and very factual about what we do, because fear and greed are our enemies in investing on both sides of it. So, and let me just say too, again, I do not want to be hyperbolic. When I say it reminds me a lot of 2007, we're gonna discuss that a lot today. It's kind of the way the show is organized and the segments that we're gonna talk about. We've got a segment we've got called "What's There Not to Like," and we're gonna look at two companies, one a local company, and I've got a feeling when we talk about this local company, who I happen to be a fan of, who I've owned the stock before. We've done well with the stock. Good company. And I'm probably going to step on some toes because, like I said, it's local. A lot of people around here own it. And there's some pretty disturbing news. It's not getting picked up in the media. No one's paying attention. But anyway, we're going to get into that. And we're going to use that. Not use it, but it's going to be an example, a microcosm, if you will, of the rest of the market, because the issues that we see in this company and that we're seeing in this company and that, you know, my little, you know, sleuthing behind the scenes and talking to some people in management, it's not just a problem with this company. And I'm still not going to tell you the name. What do they call that? It's a tease, right? I got to get my radio vernacular down. You know, I gotta speak in the right. What do they call it? What is the other term? Do you know what that other term for vernacular is? It's the
verbiage.
Yeah, rhetoric. It's along that line. The it's not the zeitgeist, but it's like the linguistic zeitgeist, right? The vernacular. I'm just blanking out here today. I'm too fired up about what we're talking about. So anyway,
lingo.
Yeah, it's you're getting closer, but you know, still. It's more of like a $10 word, right? It's very erudite. There's a $10 word. It's a snobbish word. It makes you sound smart, right? Which is why I like it.
Thinking rhetoric, right?
Well, rhetoric's right in there. What is that? This is going to drive me nuts. I feel like we should just like pause recording so I can just look it up right now. Isn't this great? This is what people are tuning in for, like anybody's actually tuning in. Right. It's there. They're like, this wacko's on the radio again. Anyway, so getting back to talk, we'll see, we're already getting derailed here. Thanks a lot, Darren. See, I blame everything on you. But anyway, I just think it's a fascinating example of what's going on. I think it puts Fed activity into the proper light. So anyway, we're going to talk about that. That's probably going to be the biggest segment. We're going to start that one up next. And then we're going to do an update on where we are in the cycle. And we're going to kind of harken back to that 2007 comment I made earlier and get into the details of why I say that. You know, just because there are some eerie similarities. There's differences, right? It's One of the things we see in investing is we refer to it as everybody fighting the last war. One of the things that we did throughout the first, we didn't do it early enough. I wish I'd have done it right out of the gate after the Fed announced the bailouts in 2009. But, you know, we've done well through banks and financial companies. Not as much recently, but in the first 5 years of the recovery. Because everybody was still so negative on it, right? They were still fighting the last war. They still were worried about the banks. And one trend you see in investing is that's always the way it is. Everybody's worried about what went wrong last time. And very seldom do we see repeat performances, right? It just doesn't happen very often. And, you know, so like I said, the banks were a perfect example of that. People were scared of the banks for a long time. And, you know, it just doesn't shake out that way. But having said that, there are similarities. You know, I don't think anybody, well, that's not true. We got a segment about that coming up too, which is investor exuberance. I want to talk about that. I have not seen a level of investor exuberance like this since probably 2000, 99, 2000. And we're going to get into that. Didn't see that in 2007. Everybody was still healing. In 2007, if you think back to it, everybody was still licking the wounds that they'd incurred during 99 and 2000. And that was one of the biggest reasons why the Jim Cramers of the world were sitting there, you know, going, oh, this market's fine. In 2007, everybody remembers the rant. I had a conversation with a prospective client the other day, and they're like, oh, no, you know, Jim called it. He said the market was going to go down. I distinctly remember that. When you're short markets or you're betting against markets, you remember things more clearly because you got a lot of skin in the game. There's a lot that could go wrong. And so I remember that day clearly. And when Jim Cramer finally lost, you know, finally gave up the bull argument for the market and said that people should be careful, that wasn't until the Dow had dropped from like 14,200 is where we peaked in 07. And I believe that was in October, early November of 07. And Cramer didn't start doing his famous CNBC rant. They don't know what they're doing. They know nothing. Until the Dow was like at 10,000. It bottomed out at like 66. So, you know, he got it halfway through. But, you know, like I said, there's so many similarities when we're at peaks of markets. First of all, the and it's unfortunate, and I'm not trying to denigrate anybody, but it's, you know, we should probably like create an indicator or something, you know, a metric. And people have it. There's the RSI and Relative Strength Index, which measures investor sentiment and well, it's actually more advanced declines. But, you know, there's investor sentiment indexes and all these other different things you can track. But one of the keys to me, when you see, and it doesn't work this way every time, but when you see retail investors really excited, you know, 9 out of 10 times, that's right at the top of the cycle. Conversely, where you see retail investors swear off stocks, they're like, I'm never doing it again, you can't get me to buy stocks, that usually is a really good indicator that you're at a bottom. And in my career, I have never seen greater levels of retail investor exuberance. And what's really amazing about that, you guys, now we'll get into the market update here. What's really amazing about that, and quite honestly, what is different about this bounce back we've had off? We're not at breakout levels. The highs on the S&P are 2940. Okay. Those are the highs that were set in September of last year. So first of all, and we sent out an email to our clients last night about this. A lot of comments, a lot of fears, which is rare because usually our clients don't contact us a lot, but a lot of people freaked out that we're not being aggressive enough. And we've been doing fine. We've been doing well. We've outperformed the market over the last, well, give or take. We're about market performance now, actually, because we've been playing it more conservative during this bounce back. But regardless, don't want to get sidetracked here. But the divergence between economic activity and this run-up that we've seen since Christmas, market has bounced back. Like I said, we're still about, 6.5%, 5.5% off the all-time highs. But we dropped 20% from the highs that were set in September, and we bottomed on December 24th. But back to the economic data, so we want to get into that. So in summer or early fall of last year, economic activity was cranking, right? We just had the Trump tax cuts. And ISM and PMI, and just to clarify, ISM is the Institute for Supply Management. That's what it stands for. And it's looking at new orders, right? It's looking at, you know, how many new, you know, businesses ordering, new trailer hitches or, you know, bolts or, you know, whatever it is that particular business is ordering. And the reason you've got it is because it's telling you what businesses see on the horizon, right? How much stuff are they buying? Are people buying, it extends to people. Anyway, what it's telling you is it's a forward-looking indicator that's saying that businesses or individuals are expecting this much economic activity and they got to load up. They got to have enough in inventory, right? They got to make those new orders and make sure they've got enough stuff, you know, to, this sounds really scientific here. it's one of those things. I'm sure you guys can all relate when you do something for a living. You get to know these things almost too well, and you go to explain it, and you're like, you intrinsically know what it is because you're anesthetized to it, right? It's not new, and then you go to explain it, and you're like, yeah, well, you know, how do I really explain that? Anyway. It's really an anticipatory reading of what businesses think they're going to do, and that's a pretty good look through to give you an indicator of which way the economy is going. Now, the PMI is the Purchasing Manufacturers Index, is a measure or an indicator of basically economic health for manufacturing and service sectors. So, what it's really looking at? Well, there's five major parts of it. So it's new orders, inventory levels, production, supplier deliveries, and employment environment. Okay, so it's really looking at, you know, are people hiring? Are businesses loading up? It's got some similarities with ISM, and ISM and PMI, they diverge at times, but they're usually going to move fairly uniform. They're looking at different aspects of businesses. One can be a little higher at one point, but usually they move in a correlated fashion. They're pretty tied together. So it's really both of them are what we call leading indicators because rather through, you know, people prognosticating, it's looking at what businesses are doing, how much inventory they're buying, and it gives you a very good look through about what they're expecting. And look, they tend to be pretty accurate because people know their businesses pretty well, right? When you're if you ask us about Bulwark, you know, I can tell you I usually can tell you within, you know, a few bucks, what kind of revenue we're going to be expecting because I know my business, right? Doesn't mean I know everybody else's. But I, you know, people typically, especially the managers in charge of these businesses, if they're good managers, that's going to bleed into our next segment. Darren, are you ready? I know you're pumped. Darren is an undercover forensic accountant in the making. I'm telling you. This guy, he's a financial sleuth. He's a very multi-talented guy. Bit of a renaissance man, really. And he's got a 4 handicap in golf, which makes me hate him. But, you know, a sweet swing. Smooth as molasses. I'm getting all fired up because I've got so much to talk about, but I keep getting derailed. See, it's like
my fault every time.
Oh, yeah. That's right. It's always your fault. That's why you got a producer. She says, hey, Zach, that was a bad show today. Yeah, the producer really bunted that one. okay. Anyway, sorry guys, I'm pumped. Sun's shining. And there's just the good stuff. Okay. So anyway, back to the subject at hand. So PMI and ISM give us a really good outlook of what businesses are expecting. Okay, those indicators peaked out at levels that they hadn't been at since 2004. Like I said, it was late summer, early fall of last year. Okay. It was either the PMI or the ISM topped out at 66, which is a massive reading. That means that businesses are pumped. Since that time, it's dropped down to 53. 52 and change is where we're current. No, let's see. PMI is at 53. I think the ISM is at 51. Don't quote me on that. Anyway, point is they've drawn back drastically. Now, those are U.S. measures, okay? Now, that being said, any reading above 50 means that there's still growth, right? Reading below 50 means that those things are contracting, that companies aren't ordering as much as they did last quarter or last month. It means they're not stocking up on inventory as much. It usually is an indicator. If we go below 50 on those readings, it's an indicator that businesses are expecting less business, right? So they're still expecting growth, but nowhere near where we were at just 6-7 months ago. Okay. Now, what's interesting, 6-7 months ago, when did the market reach its peak? 2940 on the S&P last September, right? Right around the time that those indicators were at all-time highs. Well, this surge that we've had over the last 2 months, 2.5 months now, 20% now top to bottom in 2.5 months, unbelievable. Now, there's some problems with that, too, because it's been a very low volume surge. Like I said, I'm kind of on the fence now. Remember, I was saying a couple weeks ago, I thought this was a bear market rally. I will admit it. Look, when the facts change, our opinion changes. We haven't really changed a lot the portfolio. We're not trying to time markets. We're still conservatively positioned, but we haven't sold off all of our stocks. You know, so in a lot of ways, we're enjoying this run up too. But I'm kind of on the fence now. We're at 2,800 on the S&P right now. You know, the thing that is concerning to us, though, is that, like I said, those previous market highs were reached when those ISM numbers were 66, which, like I said, this highest in 15 years, right? You'd expect the markets to be cranking at that point. Since then, the ISM and PMI readings have dropped by almost 20%, or 20-25%. So significant drops for both of them over a relatively short period of time. And the odd part about that is the markets are racing trying to get back to those all-time highs. But we know for a fact, we just got fourth quarter GDP in at 2.6%, which isn't horrible. Not nearly as strong as it was previously in the year. And from all the indicators that we're seeing, especially PMI and ISM, we would expect GDP to continue to decelerate. Now, again, we're not saying the end of the road and, you know, freak out and panic and sell everything. Not saying that. But economic activity is definitely cooled. Now, we're still growing, right? But it's definitely cooled. Now, then we look at PMI and ISM readings around the globe. Germany just posted a 47. So they're contracting. Second straight quarter in a row. Germany is essentially in recession right now. The biggest, most powerful economy in the Eurozone. China. PMIs are at 49. They're contracting for the first time in 20 years, 25 years. Australia, same thing. You see all these economic things going around the world and you see markets rallying viciously in the opposite direction. And look, maybe the markets are right. I just have not ever in my career seen a divergence of economic activity and price action in markets this drastic. Which means one of two things, right? Either the market is right, and this is just a short-term blip, and boom, it's back to... Well, that's the other weird part about it, though, right? You know, it's not like economic readings have been good in Europe. It's not like we're trying to get back to good. They've been bad. They're going from bad to worse. China is in contraction for the first... Anyway, it's just odd. It's really odd. The other thing that's odd is companies are coming out and saying, look, we see a slowdown in 2019. We're ratcheting down our earnings expectations. We're ratcheting down our revenue expectations. And their stock just keeps going in the other direction. So anyway, guys, be careful. The other thing out there right now that we're watching is there's good breadth in the market, which means there's a lot of stocks rallying. But we've seen stocks... You know, some of these high flyers, maybe not ones that you know, smaller ones, not part of the FANGs, but we've seen these stocks. There were a couple stocks we were looking at. Roku was one of them. Roku got hammered during December. It bottomed out at about $28 a share. Today, it's at almost 70. So in 2 months, the price of the stock is up 250%. Okay, that's not normal. Trade Desk is another one. It's a company that we've owned for a while. We sold it, took a nice profit on it. It just got too expensive and too crazy. Good company doing good things. That stock bottomed out on December 24th at $100 a share. It's now at 200 a share. In 2.5 months, guys, these are not normal movements. That being said, you know, you've heard me on the show now for 2.5, 3 years. These things, as bizarre as they are and as ridiculous as they are, and look, they are ridiculous. The idea that a company increases in value by double over the course of 2.5 months, like that's crazy. Unless there was some type of big event or announcement, there wasn't. And then you throw in the fact that both these companies are cash flow negative and they're trading at 10 and 15 times revenue, respectively. It's crazy. It's the craziness continues. And then I want to also reiterate, too, new valuations. Valuations have obviously gone up by 20%, right, in the market since the last, since December 24th when we bottomed. And valuations are climbing up to that peak level. So this now, once again, is the most expensive stock market in U.S. history. We've eclipsed 1999 and 1929. The only level, the only valuation metric out of probably 10 that we follow that doesn't reiterate that is P.E. ratios, price to earning ratios. They're 30, yeah, what are we at? We're about 40% above the long-term median. Median's around 15.8, 16. We're currently climbing back around 21, 22. Trailing earnings. Do not listen to, and we've talked about this on the show before, but I want to reiterate, when we're looking at earnings ratios, make sure you're looking at trailing 12-month, or they'll call it TTM PE, right? Trailing 12-month price to earnings ratio. Do not look at forward PEs. They're a joke. If you turn on CNBC or you're, you know, reading things at like, you know, money.com or thestreet.com, they're always going to talk about forward PEs. Forward PEs are worth the paper they're written on. And the way that I would equate this to clients, if we were going to go buy a business on a, you know, street corner shop or whatever, you know, a mechanic shop or whatever, that we would negotiate naturally. We would negotiate the price of the sale of that business based on the revenue and the profit that that business produced. Right? That makes sense. You know, a guy goes, "I want $1 million for the business." You go, "Well, first question out of your mouth, hopefully, would be, well, what does your revenue look like? What kind of revenue did you do last year? What has been over the last 5 years? What's the trend? And of that revenue, what are your margins? What's your profit?" You wouldn't sit there and negotiate the buy of that business based off what the owner of that business thinks is going to happen over the next 12 to 24 months. You'd take it into consideration. Right? But what's more important when we're buying something is what's happened. And what is happening? Not very, every owner of every business thinks it's going to go up, right? You ever met a CEO of a company who goes, "Well, it's, you know, company's not looking good." I mean, there are dire times. No, but especially when they're looking to sell it, right? "Oh, hey, this company's on the come. Had a couple tough quarters." And the same is true for stocks. When we're looking at valuation metrics, ignore forward-looking. Look at trailing 12. That tells you really what these companies are valued at based on what they've already done. So anyway, the other thing that we're looking at, market update. Sorry, guys. Obviously, we get stuck. You know me. We start talking about economics. I get a little sidetracked. But to tie up the market update, we've seen a lot of violent activity in oil. Quite honestly, I don't really even know what to take from that. So we're not going to expound on that. It's just been all over the place. Pretty weird. Gold has been touched to 1350 and then has just gotten hammered, especially today. I mean, it's not ridiculous, but gold's down almost 1.7% on the day. And so what it looks like with gold now is not the time. The gold has been trading now in this tight range between 1050 and 1350 for 2 years, something like that. I got to pull up the chart here to look at that. But we got back up to the upper level, that upper band, 1350, and failed. Boom, dropped right back down. Yeah, we've been in this since, let's see, how long have we been in this sideways trend in gold here? Anyway, point, yeah, no, it's been, holy smokes, yeah, going back to 5 years. 5 years, guys. That's, wow, I didn't even realize it'd been that long. Yeah, so the range has been 1050. On the low side was our bottom, 1350 the upside. So gold just, it didn't break out. So you gotta wait. Now's not the time. And like I said, you know, if you've got physical gold, do not buy and sell it. You hold that long term. That's just an insurance policy. And I think it's going to be an insurance policy that pays pretty well at some point in the future, but you could be 10 years out. I don't think so, but you could be. Other than that, you know, markets weren't a lot directional. We bumped up against 2,800 now several times. We're sitting at 2,801 on the S&P 500 right now. 2,800's proven to be a big level. So I think on a technical basis, we got to watch what's going on here at 2,800. Yeah, it's just bizarre. Like I said, I've never seen a divergence of price and economic activity this wide. So, A, either the market is being completely irrational, which would coincide really with what I'm seeing on the retail side. And we'll talk about that a little bit in the upcoming segments, I think the third or fourth segment. Because I've never seen investor sentiment this strong. And it just, you know, if this is the top of the market and I'm right and this is a bear market rally, like I said, I'm on the fence about that right now just because I got to see what we do at 2,800. And look, if you break through to new all-time highs, you got to adjust your thinking, right? Job's to get it right. It's not to be stubborn. But, you know, if this is a top, anecdotally, it checks all the boxes. You got retail investor exuberance sky high, markets racing to the upside, everybody excited. Meanwhile, all economic data, earnings expectations, revenue expectations, not just here in the U.S. on a global basis, are moving as aggressively the other direction. So you look at it on a chart, price action to economic expectations. And I mean, it's just, they kind of mirror each other over a long period of time. And then there's just been this X-like divergence. They've just crossed over and just raced in opposite directions. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the next few months. And, you know, honestly, I'm really on the fence about it right now. Obviously, you know my thoughts long term. I think we're at the end of this cycle. I think maybe if we got maybe some more room to the upside, but you know, never doubt central banks. The other thing, what have we learned over the last 10 years, right? Central banks can levitate markets a lot more than we all thought possible. So we've got to be cognizant of that. Anyway, that about does it, guys, for the market update. Oh, the other one is the VIX has gotten crushed. I didn't think we'd see the VIX index drop below 15 again, just because there's nowhere near as many people shorting the VIX. Here we are today at 1351 on the VIX, which is, again, that's bizarre. You see economic indicators just getting crushed and the VIX getting crushed at the same time. The VIX is really our fear indicator. At 1351, the VIX is telling you there is nothing to worry about. No one is concerned. To infinity and beyond, buy everything you see. That's what a 1350 reading on the VIX tells you. Coast is clear. Get greedy. Buy things with both hands. Nothing to worry about. That's kind of crazy to me. I wouldn't be nearly as, you know, if it was at 16, 17, long-term average, the average on the VIX is 20. Going back 30 years, the average. So something's got to give here. It'll be interesting to see what happens over the next couple months. This is going to be make or break time for the markets because either the economic readings are right or the markets are right. They're not both going to be right. So anyway, we got to run. We'll be right back and we're going to get into, is this a bubble? And we're going to talk about the companies that I was alluding to starting this show. And I want to break them down and I want to explain to you the concerns that we have, why we have them, and use them as an indicator to say, is this a bubble? Are we on the cusp of just another great economic breakout and we've got years left to run, or is this a bubble? And one of the great ways to look at that is looking at companies, breaking them down, and seeing, you know, how the fundamentals gel with the stock price and if the company is doing really well. And we're going to get into that. Anyway, that's coming up next. Stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach discuss key investment strategies across several asset classes, not just stocks and bonds. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
I have to tell you, what a relief for my wife and me when we got signed up for long-term care coverage. The more I learned about the fact that nearly 3 out of 4 of us will need some form of long-term care in our retirement, there are so many issues at play. For some people, they can't afford it and they become a burden on their friends and family. For others, you do have money set aside, but it wipes out everything that you've saved. And maybe most importantly, it's about having a plan so that all your children have to do is carry out your wishes. It's not a burden on them. And that's why I love the advice we got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. We started by going to one of Brian's free classes, and that's what I recommend you do to find out about all the different plans they offer. Brian does have a few classes coming up this month. Seats are limited, so sign up now at 525longtermcare.com. You'll get a free copy of Brian's book. Look too. Go to 525longtermcare.com, 525longtermcare.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, guys, let's get right into it here. This is the segment that I've been looking forward to really all week. And what we want to talk about is, there's so much talk about bubbles. We've talked about it. You guys know my opinion. And I really honestly don't think it's much of an opinion. I think the facts, I think to make the opposite side of the argument that this isn't a bubble, Jim Cramer, I always beat up on Jim Cramer. I think Jim's a good guy. I just think that he's a market cheerleader. And I think he knows nothing about macroeconomics. And he will not acknowledge the role that plays in things. And it's not everything. Markets can defy economic readings and stuff like that for a long period of time, but eventually economics are the wind, and it is which direction is it going? And, it's going to determine a lot about what happens in the world of finance. It just is. That's just the reality of it. And I just think Jim has come up in a time where markets have done nothing but elevate, and he just thinks it's to infinity and beyond always. I remember being really frustrated with him. Everybody remembers the rant that he did during the financial crisis. But, you know, up until that point, he was saying that Bear Stearns was a buy and Lehman was fine and blah, blah, you know, all this stuff. So I don't want to beat up on him. But, you know, when we invest, we've got to look deeper than just share prices. And I think this is especially important. Like I said, I know for a fact I'm going to step on some toes and tick some people off. If you find yourself getting ticked off, don't. Stop yourself right there, because now you're letting emotions roll, okay? As always on this show, we're only going to talk about facts. I'm going to throw my opinions in there, but I'm going to tell you that they're the opinions. I'm not going to spin it off like it's fact. I'm not going to spin it off my opinions as if they're gospel, okay? I am all too aware of my own frailties and my own shortfalls when it comes to investing or anything in life. And I'm going to be honest with you and tell you what those are. But that's the one of the beautiful things I love about investing and finance in general is we know what the facts are. If we're willing to dig far enough, if we're willing to do the work, we can know what the facts are. We can, through the numbers. The beautiful thing about math and numbers is that we can get past the anecdotal nonsense. We can get past the opinions. And we can get into the heart of the matter. And we've done that recently on two stocks. And the reason we picked these stocks out is because they're both good companies. To a certain extent, they're both well ran. Now the information I'm going to share with you is going to shed some light on why I think whether they're well run or not. You know, it certainly comes... It certainly turns that into more of a debate, what I'm about to share with you. But companies that are doing well, growing, posting good numbers, stock prices are insanely high on nominal reads, just in terms of how much their stock has risen in dollar terms. You know, it's one of them's in the last 3 years gone from $120, $130 a share up to $440 a share. One of them's gone from, you know, $80 a share up to like $250, right? So, and the revenues have been rising from the outside looking good. If you listen to Jim Cramer's of the world, to tell you everything's awesome, these companies are killing it. But are they? And these are important questions to ask. Because we can't just take what everybody tells us is just gospel and just believe it. Oh, Jim Cramer said it's a buy. He's going to buy stocks. Because one thing I will tell you is Jim Cramer doesn't do any of this. Most guys don't. They're reading a chart and the CEO said something good. But what is the real information? What is the data on the ground? I don't want a 30,000-foot view. And quite honestly, to the Jim Cramers of the world, I don't really care about your interview with the CEO. What is the CEO going to do? He's going to push the stock. He's going to tell you how great everything is. Why? Because he gets paid. And the biggest component of most CEOs on the S&P 500 and publicly traded companies at large are stock rewards. It's the biggest portion of their... So what are they incentivized to do? They're not going to come out and tell you, oh, now's not a good time to buy our stock. And they're going to present you with the best looking data. So, but this is the advantage of public reporting. We can dig into the data. We can interview people that are there on the ground. We can get a better feel. And the first company I want to start with, and I'm going to start with it because this is the one that's most guaranteed to step on people's toes, is Boeing, local Boeing. Best manufacturer of planes in the world. Last 3 years, Boeing stock has gone from 120, 130 a share, where it was overvalued then, quite honestly, up to 442 is what it hit today. Let's check to see where it actually finished up here. Incredible run. Best performing stock on the Dow Jones Industrial Average by far, up 36% just in the last 2 months. Funny enough, we actually bought it December 27th in our actively managed portfolio for about $318 a share and sold it for $410 as a trade. I just thought it was insanely. I just couldn't believe we made, you know, it was like 28% we made in like 3 weeks or 4 weeks or something like that. It's just crazy. But to be fair to Boeing, earnings have shot up. They've got a massive backload of jets, right? They've got like $650 billion worth of jet orders scheduled out in the next 10 years. Right? So everybody's going, everything is great. It's amazing. If they miss for a quarter, it doesn't matter because look at this giant backlog, $650 billion worth of jets. And that's all true. But remember, it doesn't matter what your revenue is. You can have a company increase its revenue by 50, 70, 100% in a year and go bankrupt. Profits are what drive stocks. Profits are what drive businesses. Profits are what drive everything. And so we started looking at Boeing, and one of the first things that caught our eyes, look, anytime you see a company as big as Boeing that has been so predictable for so long, and you know, easy to understand, essentially. I mean, there's a lot of variables, don't get me wrong, but, you know, Boeing traded in a pretty tight range for a long period of time. It'd go up at the cycles, it'd go down at the end. Right? It's a very predictable, very cyclical business. Now, all of a sudden, price of the stock has tripled. Margins have gone way up. Costs have gone way down. And these are good things on the surface, but it leaves you scratching your head and you're going, look, what does that mean? Does that mean all the other managers that came before, brilliant guys like Alan Mulally, who later went on to be the CEO of Ford, does that mean that they were garbage compared to the guy that's currently running it? Were all these other managers that inferior that this management team has made the company worth three times more? What's changed? So, and we've been looking at that for a while, reading 10Ks, kind of looking at different things, and I want to be on the bandwagon. Look, the metrics of it look really good. PE ratio on it's 25, which is insanely high for Boeing, but you know they're doing really well, and that isn't necessarily that bad, considering where the rest is, you know, where other stocks are trading. Now, we do know that they're doing debt finance buybacks, which you guys know my thoughts on that. This whole debt finance buyback thing that has been the single biggest driver of markets in the last 10 years, And the reason we say that is because corporations have purchased more stock than any other natural buyer in the markets in the last 10 years. The number one buyer of stocks in the last 10 years has been corporations themselves. And why have they been allowed to do that? Because of record low interest rates. They take out debt. They use the debt to buy back their stock. The problem with that is, I think, pretty easy to see. Usually companies take out debt to invest in their company, to build manufacturing capabilities, to build new facilities, things that produce revenue. The revenue from those things is then used to pay off the debt, right? With stock buybacks, it doesn't work that way. You go into debt, you buy the stock, and now all you've got is the debt. Sure, you don't have to pay a dividend on the stock that you purchase, but the dividend payments are typically less than the interest you're paying on the debt. So it's financial engineering at its very definition. And anytime we see companies engaging in financial engineering, that our ears should perk up, because sometimes there's reasons for it, right? All stock buybacks aren't bad. There's several companies, another local company like PACCAR that we're a fan of, and I'm not. That's not a recommendation to buy or sell. I actually think that they could do a stock buyback because I think their stock is ridiculously undervalued. They just did a shareholder special offering, a shareholder special dividend, cash dividend of $2 a share, in addition to the regular dividend they pay. And, you know, quite honestly, I'd probably prefer to see them buy back their own stock because it's so cheap. And so, you know, because companies should buy back their own stock. Buffett has talked a lot about this in the past, that when Berkshire Hathaway is trading at a discount to book value, meaning you add up their tangible assets and see what the physical price of the company should be, and the stock price is trading below that. And he says you step in there and buy. If you got free cash, buy up your own stock. It's great value. Okay, but what about when your company's trading at record valuation? Should you be buying stock back? And moreover, when it's trading at record valuation, should you be going into debt to buy back your stock? So getting into Boeing, and I'm just going to jump right into it. I spent about 3 hours this week discussing with a senior executive at Boeing who will remain nameless. They asked to be anonymous. Been there for a really long time in the accounting world. And had a fantastic conversation with this person. And I started saying to this person, hey, look, I don't mean to step on your toes, but Boeing's a perfect example. We've got big concerns about Boeing. And their eyes kind of lit up and they went, oh, really? What is it? So we kind of started getting into it. And this person knows the finances of Boeing very well. Like I said, they're in the accounting department and been there for a really long time, loves the company, and is sort of heartbroken. And I said, well, why? And she goes, the culture has really changed. I said, well, what do you mean? And she goes, basically, and I'm going to summarize, I'm not quoting here, but they said, you know, the culture has really changed because the goals are different. And I said, okay, what do you mean? And what they described to me, or the words they used, were something to the effect of, they're stripping the company. They're stripping it out. Now, I know what that means in terms, but I'll explain it to you guys. But basically, we went through this multi-hour conversation, really getting into the nuts and bolts of the accounting and how Boeing works and all that kind of stuff. And she, it's a big company. Okay. And she said, you know, we know the numbers really intimately and we've really changed course. We're not spending the same on research and development. We're not spending the same on maintenance of things. I mean, think about Boeing. Think about all the facilities they have. Think about all the maintenance that goes to keep their equipment in good working order, right? And she goes, we're deferring all that out. We're not doing any of it. We've got several buildings that need roof repairs. The roof repairs would probably cost $2 million. If we don't do them in the next couple years, we're going to have to replace the roofs. It's that far along. And rather than spending the $2 million on repairs, it's going to cost $50 million to replace. And I said, why aren't they doing the repairs? And she goes, because it's all about the bottom line. And when we asked them, this is her talking, she goes, when we asked them, hey, guys, we need to do this or we're going to end up with a $48 million excess charge to replace the roofs rather than fix them. And they go, yeah, we're going to worry about that later. And she goes, why? And they, the answer constantly from management is, have you seen the stock price? And look, that's called deferral of costs. So what that means is these record earnings coming out of Boeing, she was telling me about elevators that have been out of service for a long time that they don't want to pay to fix, HVAC units on the factory floors that have been out of commission for months that they don't want to pay to fix. They're starving the company of capital to make the earnings look as big as they can. Because it's just a drive. And, you know, part of this is concerning, right? Because we don't really want to see Boeing making the airplanes that we fly our families in doing things on the cheap. And I'm not making any allegations. I'm not alleging that they're doing that. But I'm saying that, you know, talking to people in the accounting department are saying that they are. Now, not when it comes to the parts they're using on the airplanes, stuff like this. But the point is that that's not cost cutting. That's cost deferral. You're going to pay those costs, and the longer you push them out, the more they grow. And I think that's a really big thing. If you listen to guys like Jim Cramer talk about, boy, oh, the cost-cutting measures. These aren't cost cuts. These are cost deferrals. So what else? There are several other different examples. Like I said, elevators, you know, just all these anecdotal measurements. And then the thing that really resonated with me, there was two things. A, the whole issue with the backlog, because the number one supporter, what really drives exuberance in stock prices and that's allowed Boeing to triple over such a short period of time is this giant backlog, because investors think that they've got this beautiful look through that it's never going to end, baby. We got orders stacked up for 10 years. It's never going to end. Right? But that's always the way it goes. So the two things about it were A, the backlog, and then B, the focus of management. She says that senior management openly talks about the goal, and it's an $800 stock price. How they picked $800, I don't know. But that apparently is the target, that's what they talk about. Warning number one. And look, this extrapolates out to my business. It extrapolates out to my marriage, my life, how I'm a parent, and it should extrapolate out to you. And it was a lesson that was taught to me and beat into my head. Well, as a kid, my dad would say the same thing, but the guy that really beat this into my head was my college football coach, Frosty Westring. And he used to always tell us, gentlemen, we don't worry about the outcomes. We can't control them. Oh, the only thing that we're worried about are the inputs. What are we doing? The outcomes will take care of themselves. Well, you've got a management team that is admittedly only focused on the outcomes. And they're going to do whatever they can to get to this outcome and, you know, damn the torpedoes. And that might be fun in the interim while you own their stock. But like I said, these are not permanent. These are strictly temporary. And these costs that they're deferring, that they're pushing out, they're growing bigger by the day. And it's what we call stripping a company out. Now, on top of that, if you want to know how egregious this is and how irresponsible I think their management is being, not only are they starving out maintenance and deferring these maintenance costs in the future, they're also bringing on additional debt onto the balance sheet to buy back their stock. So they're going into debt, but they're not using the debt to repair the business and take care of the golden goose. Right? They're doing it to jack up the stock price. It's a misallocation of capital, and they're doing it. They're buying back Boeing stock, going into debt to do it at the highest valuation we've seen hung on Boeing stock in the last 30 years, 40 years, something like that. It's crazy. And then in addition to the backlog, and I think this is the thing that is stunning, and if people understood it, and I haven't heard anybody talk about this. And she goes, yeah, about that backlog. And I laughed. I went, what do you mean? I thought that was the backbone of the company. And she goes, the reason the backlog grew so big was because they've sold the planes in the future. Those agreements that they've made in the future are below current costs. So if we were to deliver those airplanes today, we'd do it at a loss. And I said, well, why would they do that? And she said, they're betting on the come. They're betting that they can cut even more costs into the future and that they can get even lower input costs and that they can make it happen. That shocked me. Think about that. They've never had bigger margins. They've never cut costs so aggressively and deferred costs, right? We're not calling them cost cuts. These are deferred costs. The bill is going to come due, right? And they've got this massive backlog of planes, but if they delivered them all right now, they'd be broke because they'd lose money. Here's the other thing scary about that. Think about the inputs that go into building an airplane, right? You have got raw materials like crazy. Think about the aluminum. Well, if you look at raw material costs over the last 10 years, guys, they've been in the tank. And I said, what allowances are they making for inflation or increased input costs? They go, None. So what management is doing is they're stripping this thing down to the studs. And they've got the accelerator jammed to the floor. They're not maintaining property, plant, and equipment. They're starving out their maintenance schedules. They're not reinvesting in research and development. They've cut CapEx spending. They have stripped this sucker down as lean as they can. In addition to that, they've built a 10-year backlog on prices that they currently are not profitable at. So we know, and this is why this said, you go, Zach, well, how do you know they won't get there? If they're not repairing HVAC units and elevators and roofs, what I'm telling you is they're about out of things to cut. In addition to that, because of the group of Boeing employees that have been there for 25 and 35 years that have built the company, right, that have great work ethics, those people are retiring. Well, who's filling in their place? Millennials. And this is no knock to my millennial listeners out there, but what do we know? Not the same work ethic, much higher rate of turnover. So employment costs are going up. There's no other alternative, right? Every time you got to hire and fire somebody, right? There's training costs and lost time and all this kind of stuff. Well, you've gone from this workforce, the baby boomers that show up every day early, work every day late, put in their time, never miss a day, work when they're sick, all that kind of stuff. And you've got this new culture of people coming up that, you know, if somebody offers them an extra $5,000, they'll bounce from a job in 8 months. So your employment costs are going up. And like I said, this whole backlog issue, if you're selling planes right now at a loss when raw materials and input costs are next to the lowest level they've been at any point in the last, you know, 30, 40 years in relationship to the size of the economy. So the price of that stuff has gone up, but much slower. And it's dropped off a cliff since 2007. And a lot of those input costs haven't gotten up off the ground. Well, what happens if inflation starts picking up? And this is what we mean when we're talking about value investing, about price to perfection. This is a stock right now whose price, the price of this stock, And really not even, right? Because we've got the deferred costs that people aren't looking at. They're calling them the Kramers of the world, the Pollyannas of the world are calling them cost cuts. They're not. Those are cost deferrals. They're going to have to fix the roofs. They're going to have to fix the elevators. They're going to have to fix the HVAC units. They're just delaying that. They're pushing it off. So we know those costs are coming back online at some point. When they do, they're going to be larger. So you'll see a jump in costs. The other thing we know is that raw input, anyway, this is what we call price to perfection. You've got a stock, and even at perfection, it doesn't make any sense. But if anything goes wrong, and here's the one thing I will tell you, the only constant is change. Something's going to go wrong. Input costs are going to go up. Labor is going to become a problem. Maybe several of those things happen at one time. Maybe they have a screw up at the plant and you know, a fire or something. Who knows? But you know, this is what happens in life. It reminds me of the old adage, the guy balancing the pencil on his finger, and a gust of wind comes by and blows the pencil off his finger, and the guy standing next to him and he looks at the guy standing next to him and he goes, "What do you think, you know, why did that pencil fall off my finger?" And the guy goes, "Well, because the gust of wind blew it off." And the guy goes, "No. It fell off my finger because it wasn't balanced." Right? Had it been in a secure place, a gust of wind shouldn't have knocked it off. But the way that I was holding that pencil on my finger ensured that at some point it would, because it wasn't stable. And if something isn't stable, it's only a matter of time until a variable comes around that we didn't plan for that knocks it off. And that's the way Boeing stock is. Does that mean it couldn't go to 600, 700? Look, I don't know. What I'm saying, though, is that the fundamentals do not match up with the real story. And the interesting thing about this was talking about somebody that's got, you know, on the ground experience and on the ground knowledge of this. And it really matched up with what we were seeing, because I was just scratching my head. My analyst and I were going over going, how in the world, where have they just found this margin? Where is this? I don't believe that all of a sudden this is the smartest management team in the world. And they were able to cut costs, you know, to such a degree where all of a sudden this is a different company. I don't believe this time is different. When you try to sell me on that, I'm going to be a skeptic. And what she told me from time on the ground and experience matched up perfectly with what we were seeing. And so we get into, is this a bubble? Yes. Yes, it is. And I don't care what the Jim Cramers of the world think. If interest rates were at normal levels, 80% of this garbage wouldn't be going on. This is a central bank Fed-induced bubble. Plain and simple. That does not mean, however, that it cannot go significantly higher. I certainly have my doubts. Just because we're already the most expensive stock market in history. It's the longest stock market, longest bull market in history. You know, we're already at insanity levels. And in that light, this really makes sense. You would expect the end of something like this. And I'm not saying this is the end of it. Nobody can time markets. I've said it a million times. But it all matches up. I would expect at the end of a cycle like this, that right at the very end, when the dance was about ready to be over, that that's when the average investor would be the most excited. And we'll get into that a little bit in the next segment. But another company that matches this up is Palo Alto Networks, big cybersecurity firm, great products. They do a great job, one of the leaders in cybersecurity industry. And we've been wanting to get a play in cybersecurity for a long time. And we've been watching Palo Alto Networks and looking at it. So we really went into a big deep dive into it this last week with the analyst and I. And I'm just going to give you a quick synopsis because we got to run and I've gone over a shocker. But so first of all, look at valuation. Palo Alto Networks right now has a market capitalization of about $25 billion. It did about $2.3 billion in revenue last year. So we're looking at a company that's trading about 10.2 to 10.3 times sales. That is exorbitantly expensive, especially for a company that size. Okay. In addition to that, it is still not cash flow positive. They're still burning money. So they're still basically in startup phase. Well, yeah, but they got a $25 billion market cap. So, okay, alarm's going off, right? Do they have good revenue growth? Yes. But like I said, they have yet to turn a profit. So, you know, we're skeptical. Not that we think the company's going to fail, just that it's exorbitantly overpriced. And it's just a lot of enthusiasm is built into the price. Then we looked at the stock. They announced earnings recently that were pretty good. I didn't think it was that impressive. They had like 26% revenue growth. Don't quote me on that. I've been doing a lot of research lately and I could have. But anyway, it was good. It wasn't revenue growth that was big enough for me to pay 10 times sales for it. Just nuts, especially for a company that's got negative cash flow and is losing money. So anyway, we looked at it and price of the stock jumps through the roof. 13% or something on a single day. And we looked at it, and one of the biggest drivers for the reason the stock popped was they announced a billion share buyback. Here goes that word again, buybacks. So we broke down the balance sheet of the company and started looking at things, and wouldn't you know it, on the balance sheet, debt went from, I want to say, $600 million last quarter to $1.6 billion this quarter. They borrowed the money. This is a debt finance buyback. And this is what I'm trying to tell you. This is what I'm getting at. This is beyond opinion. Okay, in a lot of ways, Palo Alto Networks is even a more clear picture than Boeing. It's less convoluted, but this is absolutely irresponsible of management. You've got a company, the only reason you buy back stock is because A, your shares are too cheap and it presents value to shareholders to buy back the stock and consolidate the ownership. Or B, you've got excess cash and your business is mature and you don't have a better place to invest it. Well, we know that's not the case. They're cash flow negative, right? We also know that they're not cheap because they're trading at 10.2 times sales while they're cash flow negative. Why are they doing this? Because management's trying to gin the stock up and they're willing to bet the company's health to try to gin that stock up. This is financial engineering at its best, guys. And we got to get rolling. But if this is the kind of thought that you want to go into your investment portfolio, if you want this type of thought and research and, you know, exuberance, if you're interested in our bond replacement program that we're using with our clients that captures 50-60% of the upside of the stock market with no management fees, with no upfront costs, with no back-end costs, insured against loss that's been averaging somewhere between 5-7% over the last 10 years, give us a call. 866-779-RISK and 866-779-RISK. You can go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. But guys, get a second opinion. I've been saying it for years now on the radio, especially the last year and a half. Incidentally enough, the market, believe it or not, has actually gone nowhere for the last 14 months. We're made a round trip. We're flat. You need to button down the hatches, guys. We're a lot closer to the end of this thing than you think. Here's the other thing. If you want to make more money, give us a call. Because the biggest thing that we can do to help you is get those bonds replaced out of your portfolio with something that's going to actually make you money and that's insured against loss. So it's going to be cheaper than the bonds. It's going to make more than the bonds. And it's going to be safer. Common sense. No brainer. Anyway, give us a ring. You can email us. You don't have to call us directly. You can call and talk to me. We can do an interview over the phone. We can do a consultation. We'll show you what we've got versus what you've got. Compare performance and price. And it's all open. No tricks.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.